PHP Radio
on the Hackers Paradise Podcast Network,
your number one source for all things golf.
Subscribe on iTunes to never miss an episode.
And welcome back, everyone, to a brand new episode of the Off Course Podcast. I am your host, Dan Edwards. You can find me on social at Canadan Golf. You can also follow Off Course at Off Course THP. That is the mascot of Off Course, barking if you can't hear it. We're recording here evening time, which is prime for FedEx and UPS deliveries. And you know, being the Christmas hour, we might hear him a couple more times. I'm joined this week by Chris Voschall. He is a, I'm trying to nail down what you do now, Chris. You were a designer, or you may still design or demand things out of clubs. You're also doing a lot of stuff on social for Mizuno. Welcome to the show, and I'm incredibly pleased to have you on.
No, thanks so much. I was excited to find out that this was an opportunity coming up. I always want to do this and always enjoy my time chatting with you. So thank you for having me.
Yeah, you know, I think the last time we actually hung out in person, it was one of the more stressful moments of my golfing career. Do you remember?
I remember out at Country Club of the South, you hitting some balls and stuff. And I feel like I was downrange or something, or I was, someone was downrange, and we were firing balls right at somebody.
It wasn't someone. That might be cheaper. It was probably the most expensive THP camera that they have over there, which Josh thought would be a good idea to put 20 feet in front of me swinging, and said, just don't hit it. That was our review of the JPX lineup that we talked 919 at the time.
Yeah.
And so we're a whole series out. So we need to hang out again and do the same kind of thing. That was really fun.
That was. So yeah, 2 years ago, man. And all that stuff, that's old news now. There's way cooler stuff than that.
Well, I skipped your intro overall. You can find Chris at Vosh68, V-O-S-H-68 on Twitter. And it's probably good to plug Mizuno Golf NA as well. But you guys have quite a few big accounts, right? You've got one for Europe. You got a lot going on.
Yeah, we actually do. It's funny how if you look at us and how everything has kind of evolved in the last year, we were very US and Europe heavy, where we had, everything was very independent. You're starting to see things migrate and get a little bit closer together. Our website's the easiest place to look right off the bat. We used to have the US website was, let me think how to word it right, it was more e-com and sales based versus, you know, go there and learn a bunch of stuff, versus the Europe site, you got a lot of cool storytelling, better pictures and stuff. And you've seen those merge together in the past year. That's one thing that myself and then my counterpart, David Matthews over in the UK, not without a band. He doesn't have as cool a band as the other Dave Matthews. But the two of us, we made a big initiative to try to link everything up in the Western world. So you're right. Right now, there's a Mizuno Golf North America and a Mizuno Golf Europe. If you watch like the names of them, they're subtly changing. And we actually were emailing back and forth with Twitter yesterday. And you may be able to see just straight up Mizuno Golf very soon. Because
really?
It is we're all one world. It's so such a small world. So it's all coming together right now.
Yeah, on the digital platform. I mean, you can't really hide. I remember back in the day, it was so much easier to find cool, or so much harder to find cool things. You look at the different sports. I mean, things as simple as recruiting and drafting for places like the NHL. Finding someone in Europe used to be like a hidden gem. And now it's like, oh, I watched this dude on YouTube last year, you know, and I'm sitting here at my house with absolutely no credentials to be able to watch such a thing. So I definitely can relate on that from multiple avenues. And that's kind of cool. I like that it's kind of a team effort now, and not that it wasn't before, but you're certainly seeing like you're closing in on that sort of full gel experience, which is beneficial to golfers because not unlike what we just saw, the more information we get and the better information, we're better off as consumers to purchase, which is pretty cool.
And that's one of the funny things, like the guy, Dave, he's awesome over in the UK. He's the one who puts together a lot of our messaging and how we tell our story. And it's always been a very, if you look at like historically, Mizuno messaging has always been on the European side, very confident, very aggressive. I'd almost say it's a little bit more Titleist than if I were to compare it to like another company, where if you look at the messaging that we historically had in the US, it was a little bit more tongue-in-cheek, a little bit more jokey, whatever. And it's funny because they embraced a lot of the technology and a lot of the social media and stuff a lot earlier than we did. So he put together early Facebook pages, Twitter handles, Instagram, and really a lot on YouTube. And he started using me for the European YouTube channel, which was funny because it was like, you know, I'd do a whole bunch of stuff for Mizuno in the States, and we didn't really show it anywhere. And then I'd go visit people over in the UK. I'd go over, we have a meeting over there. I'd go to an account and they'd be like, oh, it's Chris. And it's like, I was more recognizable not in this country, which to me was very, very weird. So it's funny how now that we're trying to link everything up, and maybe you could just simply say it's my ego. I said, I want that over here too. So let's bring it all together. Who knows?
It has been fun watching videos with you. You did some cool stuff with obviously Luke for quite some time. You did something with Keith earlier. Was that this year?
It was almost exactly a year ago. So we played golf and it was December of last year. I think we've done a couple of them. So yeah, we went to it was freezing cold down in Sea Island and did some videos and stuff. Yeah.
You made him sweat a little bit.
A little bit. I think I surprised him by getting a tricky up and down that I got to actually push the hole, and ultimately it was like when he needed a birdie to beat me, yeah, he pulled it out pretty easily.
Yeah. Which is what those guys do on a daily basis. I enjoyed watching Charles Barkley provide some insight to golfers as to what truly is the differentiator between those guys out there on tour and what we would call the more standardized golf experience.
Yeah.
And the very happy that all my shots are not done on ProTracer, frankly. And I think Charles was hoping for the same thing.
It's funny. And I don't think people quite grasp just how good the pros are. I mean, there's a story I always like to tell. This was a time, this was going back, I'm going to say 6 or 7 years ago. We did a competition or a giveaway where it was, you could win a round with Luke Donald and Charles Howell, which was cool. It was right when Luke Donald was number one in the world. So obviously, I mean, playing fantastic golf, but we hosted a thing where all you had to do was go demo a JPX club, go hit it. You were entered into a drawing, and a really nice couple won this event. So we had them out in Atlanta at a course called Country Club of the South, where you've been.
Yep.
So it was cool. That same day, it was on a Monday. It was the Monday of the Tour Championship. So he was already in Atlanta to play in that at East Lake. Charles Howell was there to play at East Lake as well. But that same day, it was Monday, the course was closed, but the PGA section had an event at Country Club of the South. So top pros from across the state were there, and the weather wasn't great. It was cold. The course was playing tough. I think the low round any of the pros shot was something like a 70. I think Sean Coach, who's the teaching professional there, I think he shot 2 under. Maybe it was 1 under. Luke Donald showed up. He hit no warm-up, had never seen the course before, just hit a couple bunker shots as a clinic and went out there and shot a 60. I think it was a 62. Like, it was just an absolute, the easiest thing you've ever done. It's fun to see. And of course, Charles adds a great commentary to how he delivers it. But to talk about what's going on out there and how good someone like Phil, who he was playing with, how good that guy is, right?
Mm-hmm. He's just like, I see a shot, I feel like hitting it. A couple moments where he's like talking while the ball's in the air and giving, you know, 20 footers for par, whatever it was, bogey or whatever it was. Right. Like, why are you doing that? And it's fun to see that sort of side of it. And I'm a strong proponent in these match style experiences, because unlike what, you know, someone like Your Access would have, where you get to see the stark difference between the two up front and personal, sometimes on a weekly basis, in this case, it really presents that to everyone else. And I made a comment on Twitter. I'm like, what better way of a confidence booster than have a guy like Charles send a couple into the desert to remind us that, okay, we're not all going to get up and down from 30 yards over a bunker into a short pin.
Totally.
You know, well, I want to change directions a little bit, because you guys just had a really cool release. Mm-hmm. I guess it's more of an extension than a full release, would you say?
It is. Yeah. So we, last year, Mizuno entered the putter world in the U.S., which we hadn't done before, U.S. and Canada, the North America. So we launched the M-Craft line of putters, and it was three different heads and three different finishes. And really, they were extremely well received. So we showed them at the PGA show last year. They're forged putters. They're milled from there. And they were very classic shapes. They were what you'd expect from Mizuno. They would be the MP, if you will, of a Mizuno putter line. So we're excited now because the next three lines are, or the next three models are more of what I might call the JPX of the exact same line. So they're a little bit less traditional, a little bit more aggressive, three new shapes, all the same technologies, same forging, same milling, same 1025 material, same weight kit, but three new shapes that we're really excited about.
So new shapes, but certainly not shapes that are totally different from what golfers are familiar with, which is kind of cool. It's your own take on it. And I love that. I had asked questions from THPers from social and got a lot of feedback from you. So if I throw in some personal questions, definitely, I'll make a note of when it's not my question, someone else's, but, one of the ones that was asked is, do you have a favorite out of the MCraft series now? And if you do you also have a favorite finish as well?
So from the original MCraft, I immediately navigated towards, it was the Type 2 in black. The Type 2 was the more, you know, if you want to call it the ping name, like it's the more answer style, you know, Newport 2, whatever. That was the one I immediately gravitated towards. However, with the new line, I went straight into the number 5. If you're the number 5 is... it's a smaller mallet, but more squared off, and it's got the little mini slant neck. So just a little bit of offset, not a full plumber's neck, not a double bend, but like it's closest to the number 3 in the current line, but the number 3 was a double bend shaft. This is a smaller version, more squared off, and that's the one it went straight into my bag.
And in the black finish?
Currently, I have it in the white finish, just because when we ordered salesman samples and when they went around, that's what they got. So that's what I had an extra one ordered on the side for me. But I will most likely go into the black finish.
Really? I wasn't aware you could, as a Mizuno employee, have any other color than the blue in the bag.
It's funny. And of course, I was one of the big proponents of blue. This is going back like years ago. It was funny. I remember sitting in a sales meeting, or not a sales meeting, but a product meeting in Japan. And I literally threw out an idea of, what if we do our wedges in blue? And I kind of got laughed out of the room. Like, we're not going to do that. And then I think I've said it enough times that eventually we did it. And it was great. And so it sold fantastic. It was our number one sales when we came up with that one. So in the Mizuno side, on the putter world, the blue, it was funny when you look at how sales have gone with these. And, you know, I'm fortunate enough to be able to look at back end numbers to see what we brought in, what sold through. A lot of the retailers who've brought them in have been a little bit hesitant to bring in too much blue. So you'll see like the shop stock that people have, whether you're Dick's Sporting Goods, a Galaxy, a Superstore, whatever, you'll see a lot of those in black and white. However, you'll see in custom, the majority of our custom orders are blue. And that's because probably they couldn't get the white one or they couldn't get the blue one at the store. So the blue has done very, very well. And a lot of people internally are playing that blue one.
Wow. That's pretty cool. I was wondering personally when I saw the blue firsthand at the show, I think we did a video on them as well.
We did.
I definitely said these are the most Mizuno-y things I've seen in this booth today. I'm pretty sure that was verbatim. I like to make things up as I go, but you know, it's such a nice compliment. As you mentioned, I'm not sure there's another condition out there where a blue wedge would make so much sense, but when you stick the Mizuno logo on one, it's like, oh yeah, okay. I see that. I'm okay with that. the one debate we had on the forum, on the THP forum about it, was the face and just how you chose to leave it blank overall. Like, obviously it's got the nice milling, which is very attractive, but there's no badging. There's no visual representation of Mizuno. Was that a specific reason for that? Is it to keep it more classic? What was the logic there?
Yeah, we looked at when our first run of them, like I mentioned before, it was kind of the MP of putters. Like, we wanted to make them as clean and classic as we could. So the very first batch that we got in, we sampled some where we did put a Runbird like low on the heel, or you know, some sort of Mizuno logo on it, and we sampled a couple of those. And ultimately, just because, like, I'll use the number 3 for an example, which is similar to the number 6, which is a larger mallet where the shaft is, it's a double bin shaft, so it kind of gets out of the way. So a lot of the face is exposed. Mm. So when a lot of the face is exposed and you see that little logo down there, it just wasn't quite right. So the fact that it didn't quite look right and didn't look clean enough was part of why we took it away on that. So on, you know, if the entire line was plumber's neck or mini slant neck or something like that, I think we probably actually would have gone with that. But the fact that we have all the different necks on it, we wanted to keep consistency from piece to piece. And ultimately then it does clean it up a little bit. You know, if you're wanting to make the blades of putters, less is more typically. So a lot of that we want to strip down stuff. And you see that approach from a lot of the clubs we do, where it's more of a strip down aesthetically, where, you know, someone who buys a Mizuno, typically they don't want flash and bling. Typically they want a little bit classic. The blue is the one kind of exception to that.
Yeah. Well, it's to match their wedges, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. You know, it's been really fun watching the line evolve a bit. And I'm very curious to see where you guys go with it. Was there a big push to get into putters in this sort of way? I know it probably felt like a little bit of a hole for you guys moving up to this line, and you'd done some stuff in the past. Mm-hmm. Thinking, you know, back in the days, I've seen some other big names on your putters, and how important was it for you guys to make this the next step?
Yeah, so you're right. Our history of putters is pretty rich, where a lot of well-known names started with Mizuno on their name next to Mizuno on their putters. So ultimately we actually had a lot of people come to us wanting to be the next name next to a Mizuno putter. But ultimately we felt like, you know, we've got such a great history of developing, you know, quality precision parts that have really good feel. You know, ultimately it's like, do you need a name beside that? Where you could have that, but then, you know, if you look at that, it becomes that over Mizuno. So we didn't really want that. And if you look at ours, you know, the way we name things, everything is very Mizuno first. And I think that's a big thing that's pushed to us from our Japanese heritage, of even like our logo placement, our naming. Mizuno should be the most prominent thing. Like the most prominent logo should be the Runbird. The most prominent thing should be the brand. The name itself or the model itself, whether it's, you see a lot of just alphanumeric, very simple names. Imcraft is a very simple name. It's not like a catchy name, because we want it to be Mizuno first. We want you to recognize it as Mizuno. So that's part of why we didn't want to go that route. And that's why we kind of cleaned it up and went just on our own. And we knew we could develop a great product. And it's funny, because one of our designers, a guy named Kazu Doi, we've joked with him, or I've joked with him a lot, where I call him Kazu Cameron and Scotty Doi. Oh. and he doesn't like it very much.
Yeah. I thought it was funny you said catchy, and I was wondering how you spell catch.
Oh, yeah. You spell it either way.
Yeah. Well, I kind of want to touch on you a little bit, because I don't think that it has been really a ton of depth, and you've certainly moved through different positions with Mizuno at this point. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are curious about two things. Number one, what really got you into this game that we all love? And number two, if you didn't do this, what in the world would you be doing?
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, what got me into this is my dad. My dad was a golfer. He played in college. His thing, or I guess I should say our thing growing up, was my dad was kind of a equipment gearhead. And, you know, in his basement or in our basement all growing up, there was just clubs. He loved clubs. And our thing, I like to tell my Saturday morning, and, you know, from 10 years old until I was gone for college, Saturday morning, I like to wake up early with my dad. We'd go to McDonald's and get breakfast, and then we'd go to the golf store. And we'd literally hang out at the golf store. hitting putts, looking at equipment, and he had an appreciation for it and kind of passed it on to me. So it became a passion of mine really, really early. Like even before I knew, hey, that's a pretty head shape, that's not a pretty head shape, I was always the kid, and you know, even through college, through everything, who could tell you, oh, well, here's the technology list between this product and this. You know, I remember like, you know, some of the odd equipment coming out, you know, in my time, it was like the Titleist had the 962B, which was like, you know, an iron that was not the normal 962, but it had a different face shape, different offset, stuff like that. And those were the types of things that fascinated me. And I remember going looking at like MP14s and 29s at the time, and looking at like how Tiger put his set together, trying to understand why he took these clubs from here and these clubs from here. So really that was what got me into it. And that was what got me into being an equipment nerd. then to land into Mizuno, it's one of those right place at the right time things where I was graduating from school. I came across a job posting for a club engineer, and I was like, well, this is it. I found it, except for all those little, you know, fine detail things like you need 10 years experience, you know, master's degree in this, all those things that I did not have. But I applied anyway, and it just happened to be that it was the same time when we were opening up our test center at Country Club of the South. So the test center that we were at hitting balls at was opening. It was the spring of 2005 is when that was opening. And I graduated in spring or winter of 2003, got hired with Mizuno early 2004, and was brought on to kind of run that facility. So from there, it was a great opportunity to, again, go to the golf store, buy everything, and then cut it up. And really, instead of just knowing everybody's technologies, testing their technologies and learning what works and what doesn't, and what can we do better, and what do our competitors do good, what do they do bad. So that's what got me really into it. And, you know, from a testing engineer position is a perfect one to lead you into, okay, you understand what technologies work, what doesn't, why this weighting was better than this, really led me into a design world. And then working with David Llewellyn, who was my boss for the longest time in terms of designing, it was a fun progression throughout Mizuno.
That's unbelievable. And I actually remember a conversation we had while we were sitting in that specific location. You had mentioned it was right around MP20 release. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about how you had altered the shaping of the MB. And if I remember correctly, you weren't particularly involved with the design of MP20. Is that?
That's right. Okay. 20 was the first line where I wasn't a hands-on engineer on it.
That's what I thought you mentioned. Yeah. So
going back to like MP57 was the first set of irons I did. I had done some wedges and putters and stuff before that. But then I'd say I had at least some sort of hand or some sort of involvement in every product line from MP57 to JPX 919, starting at MP20 and now JPX 921. I'm a little bit in a different role. So I'm more on the sidelines looking at working with the engineers, looking at the shapes, obviously testing, and my input is still there. I still give a lot of feedback and stuff, but ultimately I am a step removed.
When going a little bit further into that conversation, you had mentioned, we were discussing how the MP18 was more of a sharper line profile versus the MP20, which had more mm-hmm. of a smoother, you know, toe side section, and you started going into things like sound and the acoustics of a club and how subtle changes even in that location can make a significant mm-hmm. impact to the overall experience. And I don't think people appreciate that enough when it comes to club design, because when you think about a muscle back or even a cavity back, you can only assume that there's so much you can do to sort of impact the experience, the sound, beyond just material. Things like shaping play a massive role, and I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, you're totally right. I mean, especially a muscle back is maybe the simplest design out there. You know, you picture there's a plane on the back, there's a plane on the top line, and there's a hosel. Other than that, there's really not many levers you can pull. But there's a lot more than you think you can. So, you know, one thing I always like to point out is, you know, the muscle back player typically is, hey, I want no offset, I want the thinnest top line available, I want it to be tiny, all of these things. However, if you look at a Mizuno muscle back, which is, I think, widely known as being one of the best feeling muscle backs, we're typically not the smallest from toe to heel. We're typically not the thinnest top line. And a lot of that comes down to engineering, not for a look, but for a performance and for a sound. So the top line is a really interesting area where if you just put a really thin top line on a golf club, that will affect the feel. That will make it feel harsher. It'll make it feel a little bit clickier, if you will, where, you know, a Mizuno muscle back, you want it to feel soft and buttery, or what, however you describe buttery in the engineering world. So there's certain frequencies you want to hit, and there are certain levers that you pull to try to hit those. So if you look at like the MP18 versus a Titleist, a TaylorMade, a Callaway muscle back, the top line is a touch thicker, and that leads to a feel. And then now there's some design tricks you can pull around that, where if you look at like the MP20, the MP20 actually appears thinner, but if you measure it like with a caliper, it actually is a little bit thicker than that even, where we do some stuff where we taper it and put aggressive bevels across the top. So everything affects everything. That's the biggest thing I like to say. Yeah. on Mizuno or on any sort of club design, is you can't just do one thing because, hey, it looks better, because that has going to have an effect somewhere.
Yeah. And I certainly appreciated from the 18 series, I was, and still am actually, bagging the MP18 SCs, because I love that CB profile. But when I hit the MP20 MBs, I was absolutely awestruck by the quality of the sound. I'm a sound guy 100%, which is why Josh toyed with me during our video on Chromoly and how obsessed I was with Hot Metal Pros last year.
Yeah.
But I would be absolutely, I will take a verbal beating from my friend David if I don't share with you that Mizuno unlocked his ability to overlook the fact that the HMBs are not blades. Mm-hmm. But he can actually play them, because if it weren't for those, he'd still be playing MBs and hating life. So I do need to extend gratitude from his perspective to you guys. Awesome. HMB is a super cool club. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to you, there's always going to be another line. That's a fair assumption. Based on track record, it's probably getting called MP22. You can nod if you agree, because no one can see you. But my question to you is, when you look at a product like HMB, I know you guys said goodbye to the SC for at least the 20 iteration, mm-hmm. and kind of doubled down on MMC. But more specifically, when you look at those like high performing profiles, where does the change come moving into the next iteration? What is the driving force on those? And especially with HMB, which did show, from at least an experience perspective, very, very positive feedback.
Yes, what's interesting, and one of the trends that we're starting to see, is, you know, a club like the SC, which obviously you're still playing and actually won a major a couple days ago. We're excited about that. But we're seeing a lot of these better players clubs, technology almost sneaking into them. And what I mean by that is, some clubs that you think are just going to be a pure basic cavity pack aren't anymore. And we've seen that from some of our competitors. And it's ultimately like, now the proving ground is, does it win in a launch monitor? That could be, win is different for some people. For some people, win is a certain launch window. For some, win is a distance. For some, it's a lot of different things. But you're starting to see a lot of technology sneak into better players' clubs. So what I would expect to see, and also we might surprise you with some naming too. We always want to say that you don't know exactly what's coming. So
you heard it here first, golf world.
I said might, so
maybe, possibly.
You're gonna expect to see some new technology and some technology enter into that MP world, even a step further than you've seen before, which is a great thing. If you can maintain look and feel and add playability, add, you know, ability to potentially unlock distance, add the ability to hit more consistent spin rates, more consistent distances, you're going to see something that's, you know, that's going to speak to everybody at all levels. So with the HMB, that was a very exciting launch for us. You know, the it's funny how the hollow body world of irons was one that we were doing for a long time. And I feel like we were ahead of the industry with our H4 and H5. And then we went away from it. And then all of a sudden the entire industry was like, oh, let's do this. So yeah. We're like, yeah, I know. So when HMB came back, you know, we're very excited about that. And what you can unlock from a hollow body is a lot of stuff. You know, it's a look of a muscle back with a playability that is worlds beyond that. So you're going to see some good improvements everywhere when we get there. But right now, the MP20 line is still doing unbelievable. So we're excited about everything that 20 is, and we're excited about everything the new JPX line is as well.
Well, I mean, part of the hype of having the MP series, and it's definitely a player profile, a player experience. And when you put something like the HMB into the hands of a guy who might possibly need it, but is unwilling to concede that sort of, you know, GI or even SGI mm-hmm. profile, they get that in their hands. They're like, wow, this is a lot easier to hit than that muscle back I've been trying to make work for the last decade.
Yeah, totally.
You know, it's a game changer. When it comes to what I am playing, I will tell you that I've spent quite a bit of time in the THB Tech studio with the 921s. Mm-hmm. And we've had some video on that. I believe you've seen that.
Yep.
Would it surprise you to know that based on what I've said about my current preference, that the Forged were by far my favorite of the line?
No, it wouldn't. So the Forged has evolved so much. The Forged has, and it's funny, like the thing that Mizuno always does best when we have a more successful product is when we put more technology but make it smaller. Mm-hmm. So many people like, okay, well, we're going to add our new technology, so it needs to appeal to everybody. So we need to make the club as big as possible. But big as possible doesn't appeal to a lot of people. So mm-hmm. a lot of times when you see us bring new technology, you see us actually shrink the club that it was before. So like if you knew the 919 Forge, the 921 Forge is just smaller than it. So bringing the chromoly material into that where it was a 1025 boron, we're able to say, hey, if we can get the same level or even slightly more performance out of it, but make it smaller, that's an even bigger victory. Then you have potential to then, hey, if the next version needs to get slightly larger, that's fine. But we always like to start on the smaller side with the new tech and then work its way up from there. Because, you know, if we all of a sudden said, here's the 921 Forge, it's as good as you're ever going to get out of this material in this process, there's nowhere to go from there. So we always start on the smaller side and then let it creep up into the player range from there. So the fact that you liked the Forge doesn't surprise me.
Well, it wasn't even so much that, because last year, I think it was last year we hung out and did that. Mm-hmm. My preference was way, way into the HMPs, and it had a lot to do with chromoly. The sound profile, once again, is always at the forefront of my mind. I was mm-hmm. really impressed with the sound improvements on 921 from the bottom end of the bag. And I think mm-hmm. that's one of the major, major changes to Forge that really turned my attention to it was it just sounds so good now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
and it's a super cool tech too. Like I don't think we hear enough about how insanely cool that tech is that you put into that.
Yeah, the Forged chromoly. I mean, chromoly is a material that was really good in Hot Metal and Hot Metal Pro, and to be able to then forge that, so get that grain structure that you want out of it, so get a softer feel out of a stronger material, is something that's pretty exciting. So the feel of it, the performance, just the entire package of that Forged it's really good. And that's why you saw that as, even though, like, you know, if you look at sales numbers, obviously the Hot Metal is going to be the club that has the largest sales potential because it's speaking to the most of the market. However, if you look at the Forged, it's a smaller sales potential, but it's got so much going on and can speak to so many players. You saw that as like the star of our line. So the very first image you saw or anyone saw of the 921 line was the smoking 921 Forged. So that was something that we were very excited to show.
Yeah. That's cool. There's a question that I think sort of relates to it, but also has to do with how ridiculous our golfer brains are. And that's from a purchase and use standpoint, not from a design standpoint. There's a concept out there that a forged iron is called soft, but a forged driver face is used for strength. Mm-hmm. How is that even remotely possible?
Let me think about how to answer that. So a forged can mean a lot of different things. So in the iron world, I think more of the reason that forged is considered soft. So the material itself to be forged, obviously you're taking a material that's then going to be able to flow into, it's still in the liquid, sorry, excuse me, still in the solid form, flow into a new shape. So it is a softer, less brittle material, because when you cast something, it becomes more brittle, because you think of it, you're pouring it into a mold, and then that's going to naturally lead to some sort of inconsistencies and certain sort of air bubbles and impurities that are in there. So a casting is typically more brittle because a forging is pushed and moved into shape in the solid state. So it's soft because of that. Where that leads to soft in the iron world, a lot of times the perception is it's softer, because to forge something, you can't go typically as extreme a construction, meaning you can't get as deep a pocket cavities. Like a 360 undercut doesn't really exist nearly unless you do some stuff after the fact, because it's tough to forge something in that direction. If you think about it, forge is a 2D process where casting is a 3D process. So if you want a very extreme iron construction, typically that's a 3D process where you need something to wrap around. On the wood side of the world, it's a little bit different, because the wood side of the world, faces, you have access to them from all directions. What I mean is, like a forged cup face or something like that on a wood, it's not that you're forging the entire head, you're just forging that face part. So you're, it actually is a two-dimensional thing where you have the face side and you have access to the back of it. So I realize I'm kind of going off on like techie engineering and manufacturing.
That's great. I'm imagining there's about 1,000 people just digging into their chairs right now trying to figure it all out with you.
Well, but ultimately forging, because it is less brittle, a brittle metal is more prone to fracture, is more prone to cracking. That's where, like, you know, if you were to bend a cast iron, it's easier to break, versus if you were to bend a forged iron, it's more likely to be malleable to actually bend. On a wood, where you want flex out of the face, you want face contribution, you want that material to actually be able to have a little give to it. So to be able to deform and return to shape without having the ability to crack. So without being prone to cracking. So you want something that's going to have a little bit of malleability. It still needs to have the strength to it. A lot of forged materials on the face are really good. So because you don't need like the three dimensions of it, because you can access the back of a forged face on a wood before you weld it on, that's why it's forged from there. I hope that made sense.
Yeah, I love it. And it's, you know, you get to see it quite a bit firsthand when you really dive into some of the tech details that are provided, but it's something that's not talked about enough, I don't think, from an education standpoint. You see a lot of forged face, even on irons now, and it's certainly a more logical reason why that would occur as opposed to casting. I want to get a little bit less techie on you and a little bit more personal from your golfing perspective. I have two pitchers up here of seven irons you might be familiar with, all JPX 921.
Yes.
And all MP20. What is in the Vauxshall bag right now?
So right now it is a combo set that crosses both pictures.
Uh-oh.
Right now it is the 921 Tours in the 9-iron 8765 and the HMB in the 3 and the 4.
Oh,
so it's
great.
A combo set with them.
Okay. That actually leads into one of the questions that I was asked to bring up during the show. And that was, how much blending are you seeing from a purchasing standpoint? And is there any real trend as to what's going on with that?
There's an absolute ton. I mean, we've kind of designed our line really starting with MP18, where we've designed them with blending in mind. So if you look at, let me think of how the best way to describe it. You know, I talk about having access to some of the sales data and looking at stuff. One of the things I love to look at is what we call component usage. So component usage, meaning I'm going to look at, I'll say, for example, the 921 Tour, and I'll look at literally through our custom department, how many 9-irons we pull, how many 8-irons, 7-irons, 6-irons, 5-irons, down to 4-irons. for every 7-iron we sell, which is typically the one you sell the most of on a club like that, for every 7-iron, I'll say for every 100 7-irons, we sell 99 8-irons, and we sell 95 6-irons. When you go to the 5-iron, you go that quickly goes to from 95 to about 85. When you go to the 4-iron, for every player who has, for every 100 players that have that 7-iron, about 40 of them have that 4-iron. So what that means is something's going in that long iron side of the bag. When you look at the component usage of like a Hot Metal Pro or the component usage of an HMB, it's like the opposite. It's almost like a dip at the 7-iron because we sell so many 2s, 3s, 4s, 5s in the long iron side that it actually spikes up there. So we do just an absolute ton of combo setting. The thing you got to understand then is how are you going to blend the sets and make sure the lofts all make sense. So like for my set, it's the actual loft of the tour on the 9, 8, 7, and 6. My 5-iron is 1 degree strong. And then my HMBs are the standard loft of the 4 and the 3. So you have a perfect 4-degree flow all the way until you get to the 3-iron, which is a 3-degree flow. But I make my 3-iron just a touch longer to make up for that. So there's a ton going on. And that's where working with a skilled fitter and working with somebody who's knowledgeable of specs is really important when you're blending sets.
That it sounds like you belong on THP, quite frankly. Gearheads over there, we love to tinker. And I'm certainly I don't want to call a victim of it, but I'm definitely not free of that label myself personally. But I think it's we had a conversation about if you had to give up all the heads in the original, the 919 JPX. The only one that would remain, if you, I'm assuming you remember, is Forge.
Yeah, yep, this is the Forge. It's, I'd say it's the best of both, of every world. You know, the Forge is the model that can speak to such a wide variety of players. The head shape itself, it's very players. It's small, it's compact, it's not overly offset. The feel is there. And then there's distance elements built in, especially on the 921, where it's got so the chromoly material and the back milling design to give you a little bit more COR to it. It's like if we could only make one golf club, if there was some weird government rule that, hey, as a golf company, you get one try. That's what we would make, guaranteed.
Do you think Hot Metal Pro closed that gap a little bit with this release?
Hot Metal Pro, what I'll say is Hot Metal Pro, the numbers it did surprised everybody with the 919 line and right out of the gates, the 921 line as well. What I'll say is Hot Metal Pro allowed Forge to get smaller. So now it's like the Hot Metal Pro can speak to so many more players because it is a little bit larger, a little bit more forgiving, that it allowed us, it gave us room to shove Forge smaller. So now it's like, you know, if you were just to make one, you could probably get away with either of those, but the Hot Metal Pro might be a touch too large for, call it a, you know, 3 handicap player, where the Forge might be a touch too small for the 12 handicap or something like that, you know?
All right, let me take it in a different direction. Okay. Should HMB continue in this unnamed, potentially not MP22 series? Do you think it has a chance of stealing that spot?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
HMB. You say HMB or HMP?
HMB. Hot Metal, Hot Metal Blade. The MP.
There are too many acronyms.
Not MP22. Yeah.
It definitely has a space there because what you're able to do when you have access to the inside is you can do a lot of cool things. You know, when it's a hollow body construction, the way you can place weight so extremely deep and back and really have no handcuffs in terms of where you can put the weight is really easy. With a Hot Metal or a Forge or a Hot Metal Pro, you can see it's an open cavity. So you don't have access to like extreme back middle because it's an open cavity. But when it's a hollow body, you have access there. So you could put mass in different places.
So I've grilled you on golf clubs But we haven't even touched on what I think we had the most in common at the time, which was a pair of golf shoes, which we both loved. And JB over at THV did not.
I'm so glad you're bringing this up. So, keep going.
So tour premieres. I don't know how much you want to talk about other companies, but I am super salty that that hasn't really continued, because I had a pair of unbelievable limiteds that are destroyed at this point.
So here's what I'm going to do.
Say goodbye to it.
Keep talking, because I'm going to bring something up to show you real quick. If you look at my eBay search history from yesterday, I'm trying to find more tour premieres because I am exactly there with you. I have not found a pair that fits as well that I like from anybody as much as my tour premieres.
Oh, man. It's funny how that goes. And when I first looked at them, I thought, there's no way that I can make these work.
Me too.
I'm not that athletic. I'm like tall, but sort of goofy. And, you know, my pants aren't skinny enough, but you certainly are fine in that regard. You got the more athletic fit. But from a pure functionality standpoint, they are durable in every condition, including heat and cold. I loved everything about them. And I need a solution. So if you find one,
yes,
because I think we're in kind of the same planet here. Let me know.
Did you try the Brooks, the Air Max ones?
The brand new ones?
Yeah.
So I bought a pair from our good friends over at Budget, and unfortunately I got charged $10 to return them because my feet are not the width of a pencil.
So I bought the tie-dye ones because I thought they were super cool looking. And it's the same thing. They're so narrow. It's a strange fit. And I haven't returned them. I still have them because I'm still convinced I'm gonna someday they're gonna fit. But I thought that they were gonna be the pair because obviously it was a Brooks thing, and Brooks was the guy, was the tour premier guy before. And what's interesting, if you look, he's been wearing tour premieres lately. So if you watch in the last couple majors, in the Masters, he was wearing tour premieres. So he's got them somewhere, but I don't have that connection.
Yeah, maybe they kick it back. I don't know. There's just something about that lineup, and I love, the big seller for me is I have such a hard time finding shoes that are fully waterproof, and that I've got some weird old hockey injuries in my feet that they can't be like super snug. So I need a shoe that's got a little bit of movement in it, and those kind of checked all the boxes from that sort of profile, whereas everything else I own is more like the fair weather days, you know, softer, I guess you call it like Flyknit kind of material, where it can certainly leak through and that kind of thing. I did buy some Code Chaos shoes, so we'll see how that goes. I haven't put them in play because end of the year for up here in Ohio, I don't want to ruin a pair of shoes moving into 21.
Let me know. I'm curious. Yeah,
I'll keep you updated on those. And I did get asked to ask you from a apparel standpoint, if you had to give up one thing on the golf course, would it be hoodies or joggers?
Personally, I love a jogger, but I haven't worn a jogger on the golf course. So
really?
When your pants are as skinny as mine, there's nothing to cinch up after that. So
true.
So I wear, obviously I wear like a pretty skinny pant because I'm a scrawny dude, but I would give up the joggers before the hoodies. I love a good hoodie.
Is there a certain type of apparel that you think just shouldn't exist in golf right now? It should just go away.
Me? I don't think so. Like I'm very much of get comfortable, enjoy it, have fun. Like it's funny. I remember when the high tops were coming back, I was like, I love the high tops. Like I'm curious. You were talking about the Flyknit ones you have. Did you have any of the Flyknit high tops?
No, I never went full highs. No,
the Flyknit high tops. They're, I know that's like 3 or 4 years old. They're fantastic. They're the best in the summer that you can wear. So no, there's not a thing I would get rid of. I love people not looking like country club robots out there. So you know, there's too many people who just wear the same thing. And you know, I joke when I see two people in the same group wearing basically this exact same generic golf outfit. So I love all the different things out there, the people wearing hoodies, people wearing joggers, high tops, whatever. I'm all about that.
Really? So like pleated khakis, not what you're looking for 21.
Well, that's probably not me, but I would love for a guy in my group to show up with pleated khakis. He's gonna hear all about it.
What is your thought on the white belt?
I rocked it for a very long time, and I've gone away from it for a while now.
Is it gone? Are we done?
It feels like it's done. I was all, when I got mine, I was so excited to get it because I wore it everywhere. Like, I actually think I think it might be on my Twitter. I have a picture of me in a white belt, but I have not worn it probably in, I'm going to call it 3 or 4 years. Now it's always a black belt or a gray belt or something. But
so no needlepoint?
I'm not a needlepoint guy. To me, the needlepoint's very country clubby, and I like to be more of like a streamlined, like more athletic, whatever look. So I don't have any of those, but hey, if you want to wear it, wear it.
Interesting. So even the skinny pants with like the athletic fit shirt, if you put a needlepoint on it, that's too country club for you?
For me. I I'm very much like, and this is going to sound ridiculous that I'm even saying all this, I don't like a hat that goes too far back. Like the slouch fit doesn't fit my head right. Like I like a taller front, which I know a lot of people don't. So I'm a little bit more flat bill, a little bit more taller front, a little bit more streamlined everything. So yeah, I like just a solid leather belt.
Okay. That's not bad. I did not expect to go on that tangent, but I loved it. That's it's still very much on course, but I did not expect the concern over the needlepoint. That's very surprising, and I love it. I got lambasted last year for having a white belt and wearing one, and that certainly deterred me from continuing. And it was too bad because I have some really cool buckles, a couple of different ones that I loved wearing, and there was kind of like a little bit of flair, you know, on there. But after I caught that heat, I was like, all right, I guess we can move on and see where things go from here.
I got an idea. Next time we do some filming, let's wear white belts, joggers, hoodies. Like, let's get it all going.
I'm in. Right. We can do some things that would deter some YouTube numbers overall, but we might have to record a second one in case it flops.
I can't wait. The Club Pro guy is going to get all over us.
Chris, do you have any questions for me?
Ooh, I didn't prepare any. Let me think.
That's why I don't tell before.
which is awesome.
Yeah.
Tell me what you're looking forward to going into 21. Like, in terms of, obviously it's going to be a different first quarter. So, you know, obviously you're privy to know some of the new things that I think are coming, or you're getting a little bit of an idea of what's coming. Golf is in a very interesting place. You know, obviously I'm a little bit, I don't know what the right word is, but being on the OEM side, I know what our projections are, what we feel like is going to happen. I want to know what you see as the next 3 to 6 months of golf. What does it look like in terms of everything?
Yeah. So I'll tell you right now, I tried to get a tee time for a weekday last week at my golf course. It was like 50 degrees. Mm-hmm. And we are... So 50 degrees, and that's phenomenal right now. It's more like 32. Mm-hmm. Completely booked all day. And this is a private course. We have a 300 plus membership. That has never happened in December ever. And I don't see that slowing down. If anything, I see it picking up. We are in kind of a weird time. Now, we don't normally talk about the Rona on off course because, you know, there's enough of that out there. But I think it's topical enough here to say that I think what is resulting in that as an opportunity to experience golf for a lot of guys who maybe had other avenues of interest or other activities that were pulling them away. And I think right now there's just not an opportunity to do those things, not to mention with a little bit of extra income, sort of opens the door to a lot more activity on the course. And once that's kind of cemented in, then you have that, like, the wave, obviously the surge is there, but there's lots of water behind it that kind of continues on for a little while. So I don't think it's a 6 month thing. I think we're going to be busy from at least the next year or two. People figure out whether golf is worth their time or not.
Right. And I love that. And I'm excited for golf. It's so funny because there was, if you were to go back a year from now, there's the conversation of golf is dying. It takes too long. It was such doom and gloom around golf, which as somebody who's on the golf course a lot, I never felt that. There was like this whole fear that, you know, it's got no place anymore, and we need to hack golf, and we need to find new ways to do that, make it shorter, make it whatever. And all of a sudden, that's not the case, and people aren't saying that. And it was like when you couldn't go out and, you know, gather at a concert or do whatever, when all of a sudden it was like, okay, now you're forced to sit back and go outside.
Yeah.
Everyone went outside to the golf course. It's unbelievable. Right. And I feel like the youth to the golf course is huge, and I think it's going to continue. And I couldn't be more excited for the sport and the game and just everything around it, everything surrounding it.
Yeah. You kind of nailed it with the youth coming out. I look at parents and the potential for kids. I mean, I have a 5-year-old who we are bouncing around whether we should send him to soccer right now, which is indoor. It wasn't so bad when it was outdoor, but indoor, it's kind of like, I just don't know. When it's golf, it's like, all right, there's the risk is low. The experience is positive. There's so many reasons to make golf a primary at this point. And I think that's really cool. I like that there are companies out there doing different things with the game, like Top Golf, some of the off versions of that. What I would love to see is more courses either create a short course for evening golf, add some lights to it, or do evening ranges that extend in a different way to allow for more hours. Because at this point, we understand that there's a certain amount of people that can get on a tee sheet. How do we extend that?
You know? Right.
That's really curious to me. And with so many people remote, what difference does it make if I go and play golf at 10 at night? You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. It's funny how with so many people remote, how I think this you want to see the bright side and everything. I think obviously everything around what's happened in the last 9 months there's been a lot of really bad about it. But I think the fact that it's been exposed how mobile everybody can be and how much more efficient and how much more your time is better used when, okay, well, I'm going to hunker down at home, get all my stuff done, and then make time for myself to go golf. Like the fact that, you know, tee sheets are still full, and I feel like the economy's moving. Everybody's nothing's like collapsing. I feel like the world needed this reset a little bit in terms of priorities and spending time for yourself and going out and doing a healthy sport, a healthy hobby like golf. It was right there, and it's been great.
And the funny thing about that is, at least from my course perspective, even though we're so busy, for the first 5 to 6 months of this time frame, the pace of play was like 345 average. It was That's cooking. Awesome. That's and it's awesome. Like, can we keep it that way? Because this is amazing. The funny part is we have more time now and we're taking less time to do it.
Right.
And I'll take quick golf any day. I'm not trying to run, but man, I have no problems playing under 4 hours.
Yeah. And I bought one of those right early on when all this was going on. I bought one of those electronic push carts with a remote that you control around, and all the guys at the office were making fun of me saying, why would you buy that? Blah, blah. But since then, it's what I love. It's got an odometer on it. I've walked 250 miles. Like, wow. It's awesome. Like, just to do that, just to say I've gotten out and I've played, I've gotten sun, I've done this, it's healthy, I've kept my distance, and I've enjoyed every second of it. So it's great.
Well, don't feel like you're alone, because on THP, I know there's a thing called the Pushcart Mafia. And it's the membership's getting pretty big on that group of people. So
I might go join like in just a few minutes. So.
Anything else for me, Chris?
No, I just appreciate all the time, and I know we got more to get to. So let's do this again. I'm open whenever you're light on content, reach out to me. I'm ready for you.
Well, yeah, that will be that's an incredible offer, and we'll definitely take you up on that. I have a book full of stuff. You get to see the weekly book.
Nice.
And I definitely didn't check it all off. So we are incredibly grateful to have you as an asset to our community. I know those who are listening are very interested in your product. You over at Mizuno are doing incredible things right now. You know, the sample size of people who are very fond of your product is not small. So once again, Vosh68 on Twitter, super, super thankful that you were on here. And you were going to say something, final thoughts?
I was just going to say thank you for y'all. I love this whole community here. It's been good. And in the last year, really getting more involved with THP community and all this it's been really, really fun. I've enjoyed every second of it. It's a great group and I want to engage even more.
Awesome. Well, hey, for everyone listening out there, please do go take some time, check out the new M-Craft series from Mizuno. As a wedge that we didn't even get to talk about, that's absolutely unbelievable. So we'll kick off on that next time. JPX 921, phenomenal product. Anyways, I'm done talking about it. I obviously love it too, because I can't stop. If you guys are golfing out there this weekend, have fun and play well and let me know how you do.
Awesome. Thanks. Thank you.
THP Radio on the Hackers Paradise Podcast Network, your number one source for all things golf. Subscribe on iTunes to never miss an episode.